Come on, buddy.
Please be seated. We'll go ahead and start with our first case, which is case number 58574, Brian Horner versus Lawrence Menza. We have Mr. Bone representing the appellants. Mr. Bone, you may proceed.
Thank you. I would like to reserve 3 minutes as rebuttal time. Thank you. Michael Bone appearing on behalf of appellant Brian Horner. This is a case that involves a claim of breach of fiduciary duty on behalf of escrow holder. Defendant Larry Semenza, Lawrence Semenza's licensed attorney here in Las Vegas. He was representing a corporation called Oilman Participation, which was a Bahamian corporation out of Liberia. I'm not sure how that works, but it's an international corporation. Oilman was the sole owner of another corporation, Newport Management, Inc., which was a Wyoming corporation. Newport Management was the owner of 4 parcels of residential real property located off of Wild Horse Golf Course in Henderson, Nevada. I believe there were 2 homes on 2 of the parcels, and 2 of the other parcels were vacant. My client, Brian Horner, who is in the court with me today, was interested in acquiring one of the parcels or one of the houses, and when communicating with the representatives from Oilman and Newport, was told that he had to buy everything, and the only way they'd sell it was if they sold the shares of the stock to the corporation that owned the 4 parcels, and thereby he can get control. So after negotiation, they agreed on a purchase price of $1,605. They came to a written agreement in March 2006. It provided for a transfer of the shares of stock in Newport Management to my client and for my client to make payments over a relatively short period of time, over a few months, the last payment being $355,000. Now, at the time, the property was subject to a list pendens and other claim and mechanics lien by a third party. The litigation involving the list pendens was ongoing. The sellers were confident the list pendens would be coming off in relatively short time, but my client was concerned he was buying a lawsuit, so it was specifically agreed to and negotiated that the last payment of $355,000 would be returned to my client if the list pendens remained on the property for more than 6 months from April 15, 2006, and that 6 month date would have been October 15, 2006. The contract also provided that the seller was going to maintain the litigation that this pendens was involved with at its own expense and indemnify my client.
So was the $355 like liquidated damages, or what was the intent under the contract?
Well,
this pendens wasn't expunged by that cutoff date.
The district court deemed it as liquidated damages, but the district court also said that Mr. Semenza, not being a party to the contract, being an independent third-party escrow holder, could not raise any issues regarding the validity of the liquidated damages clause, because liquidated damages are really only 2 parties to the contract. In all the cases, they parties to the contract. So he could not avail himself to an unfair liquidated damages argument.
Mr. Bowden, as between your client and Mr. Semenza, how would you characterize that $355,000?
I haven't found a better term than liquidated damages. As between my client and Mr. Semenza?
Yes.
Well, that was the sum that my client was entitled to. After the 6 months, the list pen was not removed. In fact, the list pen was not removed for almost an entire year. It was removed the following March. And because of his duties as an escrow holder to my client, your question was how would I characterize
it? Would you characterize that last payment? I mean, as an escrow agent, which was the role that Mr. Semenza was in your client's agreement with Mr. Semenza, if the condition that was placed upon, that was on the property was not removed, in your mind, between your client and Mr. Semenza, the obligation clearly was is that that money should go back to your client, period.
Correct.
Just no longer obligated to pay it, correct?
that my client was absent. And the obligation, right, Mr. Semenza was acting as the escrow agent. As the escrow agent, he has a dual fiduciary duty to both the buyer and the seller. And under the duties of an escrow agent, he's got the obligation to act with scrupulous skill and honesty and to strictly comply with the terms of the agreement.
So by releasing that $355,000, when in fact the Ms. Pendens remained alive and well, that's the error, bottom line.
That's correct. And the district court judge, and when we filed this lawsuit a couple of years after everything went down, the defendants immediately filed a motion to dismiss. Judge Silver at the time denied the motion to dismiss and made a specific finding that Lawrence Semenza was in fact acting as escrow agent. And
there was some discussion in the record as to some collateral discussions that were held between your client and I presume the other party, and Mr. Semenza was present, that even if the Les Pendens were not removed by that date, he still wanted to go forward with the transaction. It was not written, but there was some statement there. It doesn't take away the obligation to notify your client before the money is paid out. But wasn't there some collateral discussions about whether or not he still wanted to go forward with this purported deal?
Well, the deal was, the documents were signed in March, and all the payments were made by April. I believe the last payment was tardy by a week or two or three. I'm not sure of the exact date. But the seller never complained, and the seller continued to agree to go through with the deal. Did I answer your question?
The question was kind of a factual basis. There was some discussion that even if the last payments weren't clear, because I know in the contract it said, do this by date certain to give the money back, but there was an additional 6 months floating to take care of the ongoing lawsuits. He was aware of the ongoing lawsuits. That doesn't necessarily relieve Mr. Semenza of either refunding the money or notifying the party that what he was doing. But did that alter or change because he had indicated that he still wanted to go forward with the deal?
Well, the money was already paid by my client. He was in neck deep. There was no way really for him to get out of it. The seller, like I said, is a shell corporation out of the Bahamas and or Liberia. One of the defendants and respondents' arguments is, well, we still have them as a possibility to go after. They did file a third-party claim against them and haven't been able to collect on anything. It's not anything being chased. So my client did want to go through with the deal.
There was some discussion in the record in terms of the complaint being filed, and the request was for actual damages. Is that the damage of, say, what was lost or what had to be expended to complete the transaction, such as clearing any outstanding liens, less payments, whatever, as the property, and potential, say, loss profit for the resale of those properties, or how should we consider that?
Well, the issue here is that of damages. The district court made three findings, one that Mr. Semenza was the escrow agent, and that I believe is properly supported in the record. The next is that he breached his duty as escrow holder by paying the money not to Mr. Horner but to his other client. And then the issue comes of damages. And once you have that kind of action, it's technically a breach of contract because escrow is a three-way contract. It's also a breach of fiduciary duty. It's also a conversion. And breach of fiduciary duty and conversion, a situation like this, are essentially two sides of the same coin. Because the breach of fiduciary duty is paying out the money you're not supposed to, the party you're not supposed to, and the conversion, technically, is also paying out money to a person you're not supposed to. And I believe the Winchell versus Schiff has that holding. Winchell versus Schiff case has that holding as well.
Coming to the quick of it, is your position that we should just look at damages because of the breach, or should we look at the damages based upon the totality of the situation?
Well, the action being paying out the money to the party that is not entitled to it is a conversion. And the damages, the measure of damages for conversion is the value of the property or the money which is wrongfully paid. And the respondents and defendants in their briefs interchange the terms actual damages with the term of,
Mr. Semenza asked for some equitable consideration in this circumstance. Is he entitled to that defense from your standpoint? And why not, if so?
Well, he has a fiduciary duty, which is the highest duty implied at law. You have the duty of loyalty, you have the duty of disclosure, you have the duty of honesty. As an escrow agent, you have the duty to comply with the terms of the escrow.
I get that, but we're talking equity. So tell me in equity why he shouldn't be able to.
Because we are in equity, and in equity, first of all, there's no facts that support his argument. And secondly, the duties of the fiduciary duties of an escrow holder would require him to make payment to the party that is entitled to it. In an analogous situation, if you have a fiduciary relationship, if you do something in violation of that relationship, you have to first make a full disclosure and then get the approval from the other party. This didn't happen here. Mr. Semenza just paid the money out and didn't tell his client. And in fact, we weren't even sure the date he had paid the money out until after we had made a request in discovery. It was, they didn't give it to us. We had to get an order from the discovery commissioner for them to produce the documents to show when the money was paid.
There was some information in the ongoing, there was an attempt or effort or actual sales of the property. Your client was negotiating sales of the property that were coming across during this period of time? Or did I misread that?
I do know for a fact that my client was attempting and did sell at least one of the properties. This deal went down in March 2006, and as we know, about a year later is when the economy started to tumble and sales started to go down. And my client, I do know, was able to liquidate one of the properties after the pendings was lifted. And I do know that he wasn't able to sell it while the pendings was still on the property. But, you know, the point that I'm attempting to stress is it's a conversion. The measure for damages for conversion is the amount of the money or the value of the property. And that's what's here. In the Hart versus Hecht case, which an attorney, again, acting as escrow agent there, the court reversed a dismissal against Mr. Hecht, the attorney and escrow holder, and found that the district court should have entered judgment in favor of the Mr. Hecht's client in the amount of the money that Mr. Hecht paid in contravention of the agreement. And here, the $355,000 is the same as the money that was paid in contravention of the agreement.
Did you want to reserve the balance of your time for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Okay, Ms. Toney, on behalf of the respondent.
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Sherry Thum, and I represent the respondent, cross-appellant Lance Semenza. Thank you very much for hearing us. Today we're here on the appeal of an order on a motion in limine and a cross-appeal of an order on summary judgment. If the court affirms the order on the motion in limine, there's no need to consider the cross-appeal. So the issue, the real issue on appeal is the granting of the motion in limine. And that motion limited damages to actual damages suffered, not contractual damages. And the standard on that motion is an abuse of discretion. Did the district court act in an arbitrary or capricious manner? Did the district court exceed the bounds of law or reason in her ruling?
Wasn't that a legal issue, though, how you classify the damages?
Well, the type of damages would be a legal issue, and that would have been included in the motion for summary judgment, but that's not on appeal. He didn't appeal the motion for summary judgment. Mr. Horner only appealed the granting of the motion in limine. Now, the court's ruling was based on the applicable law and the admitted facts. The facts were that the agreement, this purchase agreement that contained this $355,000 clause, was between Oilman and Mr. Horner. Mr. Semenza was not a party to this agreement. He did not prepare the agreement, and he was identified specifically in the agreement as Oilman's counsel. Now, where the plaintiff disagrees with the district court is how the court applied the law. And the district court cited Broussard v. Hill, which generally governs the duties of escrow holders, and she already found in the motion to dismiss the beginning of the case that he was an escrow holder. And the court said that liability for the premature release of escrow funds requires a causal connection between the noncompliance and the resulting damages. And here, the only cause of compliance, the only resulting damages, it's not the $355,000, it's the actual damages caused by the delay in the release of the list pendants.
And how you would characterize that, how? Or obviously, that has to presumably be something that is determined at the law, because we simply can't do that.
Right. That is, yeah. And the actual damages are actually in the record. The court said they're no more than $40,000. We stipulated to a judgment of $20,000, and we presented evidence of $30,000 in damages. The lower court even gave Mr. Horner another 60 days to develop more actual damages after she made the ruling on the motion to eliminate, and there weren't any more.
Also, going back to your opening point, is your position that Mr. Smenzel was not an escrow agent?
Yes, actually, that is our position. That's more the cross-appeal and the appeal. We originally moved to dismiss saying that he was not an escrow agent because he was not a party to the agreement, and he was specifically identified as Oilman's agent.
But did he not voluntarily then accept these funds from the other party?
He did. He did accept the funds, but he didn't agree to be bound to return the funds, the $355,000, if the condition didn't pass. But that's an issue on cross-appeal. Now, the court, counsel cites Hart v. Hecht and also Broussard, saying it's only the amounts paid in contravention of the agreement that are at issue. But really, in Hart and in Broussard and in most of the other cases cited, we don't have an issue where there's liquidated damages on one hand and actual damages on the other hand. In the Hart v. Hecht case, in the Broussard case, the amounts that were alleged to be damages were the actual damages. For example, in the Hart case, the escrow agent paid a contractor and didn't obtain lien releases. And then the homeowner was actually hit with a judgment for those unpaid liens. Well, that's not the case here. The case here is that Mr. Semenza remitted money to Oilman based on Oilman's instruction, and the $355 is an amount agreed to between Oilman and Mr. Horner. So the district court's point was, we're not going to bind Mr. Horner to an agreement that he did not agree. He's not a party to. And therefore, that if you were to do that, if you were to hold Mr. Semenza liable for the $355, you'd essentially be holding him liable as a party to the agreement. And if that's the case, then the district court erred because it should have permitted Mr. Semenza to assert the defenses, estoppel, ratification, the same defenses that Oilman would have been able to assert had Oilman been the defendant. So essentially, you know, Mr. Horner wants it both ways. He wants to use that liquidated damages and say that's his damages, but he doesn't want to give Mr. Semenza the opportunity to assert the same defenses that Oilman would have been able to assert.
Mr. Semenza had an obligation to notify the other party that he was releasing those funds.
Well, that is a question of fact the district court did not, well, the district court didn't address that. There were competing expert opinions as to whether he had the duty to do that. There was also, right before he did that, the month before he released the funds, he was sitting at a deposition with Mr. Horner, in which Mr. Horner acknowledged that he knew that the funds were there, that he didn't make a demand for the funds, and instead of it, he was either going to allow Oilman and Semenza to continue with the litigation and get the liens resolved, or he was going to then take the money and resolve it himself. Well, Oilman and Semenza resolved the liens, resolved the list pendants, and the only damages that he suffered were the stipulated $20,000 in actual damages. So the court, the issues in this case are a bit unique because it is unusual that you might have, and none of the cases really address, where you have liquidated damages provision and an actual damages provision.
If, as you have attempted to structure your argument, that certain things aren't before this court, that certain things were found by the lower court and they're not on appeal, are we not bound then to accept what that lower court did?
Well, the lower court found a breach of duty, and we are appealing that in our cross appeal, the breach of fiduciary duty. And the reason that we're appealing that, that should have been an issue of fact for the district court. It wasn't an automatic. There isn't an automatic. He didn't cite anything that automatically says that if you don't notify, you automatically breach. So there was Oilman's obligations under the agreement.
Well, there's a duty if, in fact, the district court made the finding that Mr. Semenza was acting in the capacity that's being asserted. And they seem to say He was acting in that capacity by accepting the money. Even though he wasn't a party to that agreement, he can do it by voluntarily accepting the money. So if we start from there, then where do we go?
Where we would go is, what is the scope of that duty? What is the scope? Is he only supposed to hold the funds, or is he required to automatically return the funds? There isn't any provision. It says that he will receive the funds back, but there isn't any provision as to whether he needs to demand them, who needs to pay them.
The difficulty in the argument is Mr. Semenza was in a dual capacity, so he had some understanding of the scope of what the party holding the funds is supposed to do, even though he wasn't technically a party to that contract by being the attorney. Are we just supposed to act as if that portion of the contract is not there? How should we see it? Or shouldn't we see it?
Well, what we should do is present it before the jury. I mean, if you're going to find generally breach of duty is a question of fact, and here the district court found it as a matter of law. So Mr. Semenza should have been able to argue to a jury the estoppel argument, the ratification argument, the fact that Mr. Horner did not make a demand for the funds until 2.5 years after.
Based on case law, is he obligated to make a demand for that? Or based upon the way it was structured, the money must be returned if X doesn't happen on a certain date, or in this case, 6 months thereafter, unless he notifies the party?
Well, the district court didn't make that finding, didn't make a finding either way on that issue.
I asked the question, do you have an answer?
Well, I believe that, yes, he should have been required to make a demand. And we did have a discussion about that with the district court, about that he should have made a demand and not just allowed this to happen in 2.5 years after the condition passed, all of a sudden demand the money back.
Mr. Bowen, on behalf of his client, has asserted that equitable consideration should not be allowed in this particular case. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would respond that if you are going to hold Mr. Semenza to the same standard that you would hold Oilman to under the contract, and if Oilman had the obligation or ability to make that equitable argument, that Mr. Semenza should similarly be able to make that equitable argument. So what's equitable here is Mr. Horner received 4 properties. He received Oilman cleared the list pendants on those properties, and he was able to do with them what they will. He was able to sell 2 of them and maintain the other 2, and he suffered actual damages in the record of about $30,000.
When was the list pendants cleared?
It was unconditional. It was conditionally cleared in March of 2007 and then unconditionally cleared in October of 2007. So he was able to sell the properties as early as March of 2007, but then that money had to stay it had to be preserved, couldn't be used for anything else until they absolutely
cleared. So the judge expunged the list pendants but required security until the court had an opportunity to sort out the merits of it. Is that what happened?
Yes, to be clear as to who was the owner of the property.
Okay.
So for Mr. Horner to then come back and be able to recover 2.5 years later, recover that money, not from Norman, but from Mr. Semenza, results in a windfall for Mr. Horner. And that's simply what equity is not meant to compensate him, to give him that windfall.
Ms. Dunn, you have a cross appeal, so you're entitled to reserve some time if you want on the cross appeal issues, or you can go ahead and use it all now, whatever you prefer.
I'll reserve a couple of minutes on the cross on the rebuttal to the cross appeal.
Okay.
Quickly, though, as the initial issues on the cross appeal, I just wanted to indicate we argued that the court erred in finding duty as a matter of law because there should have been some facts, should have been able to consider some facts as to the scope of the duty, his agreement, Mr. Semenza's understanding of the scope of the duty, and that the issue that he was also specifically acting as Oilman's counsel. The second issue that we address is that the court erred in finding breach of duty as a matter of law, and we've discussed that a bit here today. Oilman's obligation under the contract was to return the money. Does that mean that Mr. Semenza's obligation was to automatically return the money? The late demand is also an issue to be taken into account under breach of duty. And Mr. Horner's own testimony in May of 2007, before the money was actually distributed to Oilman, where he said he knew about the money and he hadn't demanded it because he was relying on Oilman and Semenza to clear those list pendants. And the money was held until after the conditional clearance of the list pendants. And then the third issue on the cross appeal is because the judge found breach as a matter of law, the judge precluded Mr. Semenza from arguing the estoppel and ratification. And ratification, specifically a breach of an escrow of a depository agreement, can be ratified by the depositor. And so Mr. Semenza should have been permitted that by Mr. Horner's inaction and testimony that he wasn't demanding the money, that that could be considered a ratification. Thank you.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes left for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Bowman.
Hey.
Can you clarify in the notice of appeal, did you appeal both the order granting motion and the order granting summary judgments?
I can tell you in the stipulated judgment we specifically reserved the right to appeal the various motions, the motions for summary judgment and the motion in limine. And the big issue here is the issue of the damages. The defendant has been intertwining the phrases actual damages, which is not the standard. The standard under Broussard is all resulting damages. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the contract spells out what the damages are. It's $355,000. You give a clean reading to the contract. Mr. Semenza, as the independent third party, neutral third party, cannot avail himself to any defenses of one side or the other if he's supposed to be the neutral party. If there is a dispute as to the ownership of the property or where the money is supposed to go, he is supposed to hold on to the money and seek guidance from the court or file an interpleader action. And there's a legion of cases that hold that. And that is complying with his duties to both sides of the transaction. He has a fiduciary duty to both sides. And that fiduciary duty trumps the estoppel and reliance arguments because he has a fiduciary obligation to pay the money who is entitled to the money. If there's an issue about that, you have the interpleader remedy, and it absolves him of any liability for that.
So, Mr. Byrne, how do you respond to the suggestion that the respondent makes that instead of looking at actual damages or evidence that would support a showing of damages without a modifier, that the $355,000 is the correct amount, when in fact your client had the benefit of the value of all four properties ultimately?
Well, ultimately he did, but while the time period that he owned it subject to this pendency, he really didn't. And I made the analogy of the bundle of rights. He was a denied part of that bundle, so he didn't have the benefit of that time period.
So how does that calculate the damages? What stick was missing and what was that stick worth?
The ability to convey, because he couldn't convey because it was encumbered.
But he ultimately
was able to, but it was encumbered for that time period.
So the measure of damage should be that time period where he was not able to sell, perhaps?
No, the amount of damages, if I may respectfully disagree, is the $355,000 set forth in the contract. And that's the proper standard for a conversion. And when a fiduciary wrongfully pays money or property to another person, it's a conversion, and the proper measure of damages for conversion is the value of the money or the property. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Stone.
Thank you. I think Mr. Byrne only really addressed one issue that would be relevant to the cross appeal, and that would be the estoppel. And he said a fiduciary duty trumps the estoppel, but he didn't cite any cases to indicate that we never consider equitable estoppel when there's a fiduciary duty or ratification or any of the defenses that Mr. Semenza sought to offer.
So you deny the escrow agent status altogether, but
we do appeal that, yes, Your Honor. That was initially found by the district court, but even if the district court's finding on that is affirmed, then there should be an issue of fact as to breach of duty and whether...
So the district court and these findings on all issues did it through a mechanism of the motion in limine and through a summary judgment. There was no type of evidentiary hearing here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. So in the end, I don't think there's any reason to argue or any support for the argument that somehow because there's a fiduciary duty found that trumps any other defense that would be applicable. And so I ask that you reverse that finding.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you
both for your excellent briefs and arguments, and we will take the matter under submission.